and welcome to the Unhinged History Podcast, the podcast where we have chosen not to record in the early mornings so that Angie would be conscious. I'm Teresa, and I've made sure to take a decent amount of time to pull together a ton of really bizarre notes about a really bizarre person, and that's Angie. And Angie.
Oh, I'm not the bizarre person?
No.
I got it.
But I'm so grateful that you paused and you were like, I can't believe she would choose to call me out like that with her full chest.
Like, we just got here. Damn, girl.
I woke up and chose violence. What's your excuse?
I have none. I am that bizarre, so it's fine.
That's fair. And I let the chaos rule.
You know, every now and then you just got to be a little chaos goblin.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I let routine rule my life so often that sometimes I just got to break free. And I almost went full queen there. I almost went just Freddie Mercury on that one. But I just...
You know, I'm going to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe you are letting the chaos rule because it is much, much later than Christmas, and you do appear to be wearing a button that, or a brooch, if you will, that has a unicorn wearing a scarf and Christmas ornament.
It is not. It is a, let me get this much closer to the screen.
Oh, okay. It's not a Christmas decoration
It is a enamel pin of a kitten, which is a Japanese mythological animal, and a young girl riding its back.
I think that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. When you get a chance, I need you to go back and watch this footage and see where I got unicorn wearing a scarf.
I mean, look, honestly, it's me. I wouldn't be surprised if a unicorn wearing a scarf was a part of my ensemble here in late April.
Here we are, you know?
Yeah.
These are things.
So I think who went first? I think I went first last time.
I can check.
It was the Siege of Kaffa.
I actually have notes on.
Where I was, you know, flinging bodies over walls, or maybe not, allegedly.
I allegedly was or wasn't. Yes, you were in fact first last week.
In which case, I've got a hell of a palate cleanser. I don't know what you're bringing.
Mine does not need any palate cleansing. So from what it sounds like, we are here to bring joy and sparkles, glitter everywhere today. So you want me to go first? That's what I'm hearing.
Okay. Knock it out of the park. Tell me what we're doing.
Okay. So here's the thing. I was really, really proud of myself. I thought I was going to come to you with only three sources, but I lied. I lied from the very beginning to myself and to everyone, so I owe you all an apology. I have like 11 sources. Because, you know, when you are midway through your notes and something just smacks you in the face and you then have to figure out what that thing is, you know, like I have to include those sources too, right? Because I didn't previously have this information, so how can I say that I don't need a source for it? That's my thought.
You know what? All this checks.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. What are we
playing with? So on March 21st of this year, some Congressional Medal of Honors were
March 21st?
Awarded of this year. Yeah. So just a few weeks ago.
Yep. Okay. Paying attention.
Are you aware of my story?
No. Like, I don't
shots
pay
firing?
Attention to our Congress.
Okay.
Which I feel is a better move for my mental health.
Truly, and I don't pay attention to this normal news either. However, I do pay attention to unusual news or historical news. So, like, my feeds are, that's pretty much all that it includes, and royal news, because I'm a sucker. So here we are. So I'm just going to hit you right off the bat. There's no way for me to bury the lead here. I'm going to hit you with some of my sources. The Top Secret World War II Unit That Fooled the Nazis, History.com by Christopher Klein. This article was published March 3rd of 22. At long last, a gold medal for America's World War II Ghost Army. This was a New York Times article that was written by John Ishmael, and it is dated March 21, of this year. So I think that's really awesome that we have like
Recent
not
freaking
today,
news.
but like recent news. Yeah, and it makes me so happy.
Feels like it may have
StoryCorps.
only been last week.
In fact, StoryCorps, leader of the World War II Ghost Army, reflects on fooling the Germans. This was an NPR article by Camille Kerman and Emma Bowen from May 25th of 2019. War History Online has a really great kind of compilation of information on the War of Subterfuge, Four Great Military Deceptions of World War II. I really love the name of this one. Dropping Bombs on Patton, Profanity and Character, the Modern War Institute at West Point. This was written by Ronald Roberts in 2018. So your boy Patton's gonna be featured in the story.
I'm for this, and I'm grateful that you refer to him as my boy Patton.
You know, I just feel like you are kindred spirits.
I've never shoveled shit in Louisiana, but I feel like.
I feel like, okay, there's probably some things that he did that you've never done, nor would you ever even think to do, but I also
Oh,
feel like he would
I
take
was
one look at you and
the
you'd be a favorite
shoveling
person.
shit was a quote from the movie Patton, by the way.
You figured. It's been
Oh,
some
okay.
time since I
All right.
watched Patton, but I think like years. So there is some British Resistance Archives, which is an amazing source for really anything that you have questions about, called Operation Titanic. A Smithsonian Magazine, When an Army of Artists Fooled Hitler. The
Army of
National World War II
Artists.
Museum.org, Traveling Exhibits, Ghost Army, Combat Con Artist, World War II. And then there's also a really fun source that I'm just mentioning because it comes back later. It's called 10 Little Known Facts About the Ghost Army. And this is features a work by historian Rick Baer, who produced and directed the award-winning documentary on PBS called The Ghost Army, which he co-wrote with Liz Salas. Since then, he has worked incredibly hard to get the troops of this platoon the recognition they deserve. And I think it's really important to just point out that this was like his project, you know, like he set out to achieve this goal and he eventually does. So with all that to say, I'm going to start off my story with a great quote from history.com's Christopher Klein. Members of the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops and the 3133rd Signal Company Special, who literally practiced the art of war, saved the lives of thousands of American servicemen, and earned one of the country's highest civilian honors. So, hopefully, I can get through this in one go without taking up all the time. I do have to give you just a little, like a paragraph of backup. Leading up to D-Day, the Americans have been keeping an eye on the British, and they're very effective game that they're playing in the North African arena. And just to be like frank about this, I know it's a world war, but I kind of for like it's not that I forgot, it's that I didn't fully realize like Africa was involved. Like I
Yeah.
knew that, but it like punched me in the face, like, oh my God, yeah, it's not just the European theater, it's not just
Well, I mean, you have Rommel
Hawaii
with
and
his
Japan,
tanks
you know?
rolling through Africa.
Right. And like, I don't know why when I read that, I was like, oh my God, how did I like not realize with all the things I've read and all the things I've learned, like, how did I not fully like comprehend what World War means? Like,
You
I
know,
just didn't.
I will be honest, like just now I sounded pretty haughty, like I'm pretty sure of myself, but I think there's that thing where the second you hear another speaker go, I had forgotten, and you go, well, of course. But then when you're reading the material firsthand, you're, oh my gosh, yes, I remember that. Because
That's the thing.
you read the headline and your brain goes, I'll be back in five.
Yeah, that's pretty much exactly what it did. Like, I literally went, excuse me, are you sure I'm reading about the right war? Because for whatever reason, my brain immediately went to like that romantic era of the Boer War. Like, of all the stupid things, but that's where my brain went. So, anyway, the Americans are keeping, like I said, they're keeping an eye on the British and they're super impressed with what the British are doing in North Africa, and it gives the Americans a super solid idea. So, the British War of Subterfuge just sort of sets the scene a little bit. So basically, they're tricking Rommel, right? As early as 1940, British agents were spreading misinformation to make the Germans believe that attacks were imminent at specific times and places when, in fact, they had nothing planned. This distracted the Germans as well as exposing their weakness. Think like fuel shortages, people movements. Like, we are messing with the Germans left and right, and it's
Right.
truly working to show us where their lines falter. In one instance of absolute genius, during the Battle of Alamein, which took place on October to November of 1942, the British used radio signals, agents, and aerial reconnaissance to mislead the Germans about troop movements. However, should the Nazis have been able to actually like check the actual recon and done the actual work, they would have seen that the math is not mathing and things aren't lining up, thus would have undermined the whole British operation. But the basic gist is the British build a water pipeline heading south through the desert. Its direction of travel and the time taken to erect it indicates that they will be supplying a major assault in that area, which would later launch in the middle of November. Meanwhile, the real preparations are underway much further north. Troops and vehicles are disguised to hide from aerial recon, and while the British attack in the north, it sends the German forces under Rommel reeling because they have been preparing for this fight of the century in the south forever, because that's what the British made them believe. So this leads us to another Operation Mincemeat. Are you familiar with this?
No.
So it's basically, in a real short version, it's one of the most famous deceptions of the war. Operation Mincemeat was part of a broader campaign to mislead the Axis powers. So basically, as the Allies are preparing to invade Italy, starting in Sicily, their goal is to divert attention away from this obvious target. False information has led to the Germans to believe they had intercepted vital intelligence about a coming invasion further east. This very clever operation involved dressing up a dead civilian as an officer and completing the outfit with false paperwork and identity.
I know that, yeah, I've read about that.
Yeah, I thought maybe you had. And suppose invasion plans were placed on his body. He was then dropped off at sea in a place where he'd be guaranteed to be picked up by the locals who are sympathetic to the Axis. And I think that is just absolutely genius. And like, we see this in movies and TV shows today, this type of cloak and dagger type mirrors, smoke and mirrors kind of thing. But to see it actually working in real life scenarios was just so wild to me. The Germans did, in fact, and the Italians stumble upon the false plans and would divert their forces away from the actual invasion zone, thus paving the way for a safer invasion of Sicily. Now, enter the US, who I've mentioned before has been watching the British confuse and abuse the Axis for a while now, and they're faced with an interesting problem. Are you familiar with the Atlantic Wall?
No.
Okay. So the Atlantic Wall is basically a string of super defensive posts along the coast with 12,000 fortifications. And
Coast
just for
of
funsies,
just confirming I know where we're talking about.
like the Atlantic seaboard of Europe. So
Okay.
Britain in that area, okay?
Yeah.
So just
Like
for funsies, they also have,
Jersey and okay.
you're thinking the right area, yeah. They also have at least 6.5 million mines. And every time I read 12,000 fortifications, I think that's insane and it should be 1,200, but like, what do I know? So they're trying to prepare for this invasion at Normandy, and they see all this, and they know they have to deal with it, and the Americans feel some type of way about it. And I'm sure the Nazis don't. The Nazis are looking at their fortifications and thinking, oh, we're golden. Like, this is not something we're going to have to worry about. So the Americans come up with the best way to weaken the enemy position, assuming that that would be to trick Hitler into thinking they're attacking elsewhere. Enter the First United States Army Group, or FUSAG, which would become to be known as the Ghost Army and numbered at about 1,100 troops.
Hold on real
Now,
quick.
these guys.
FUSAG, you can't zip past that because FUSAG sounds like some acronym that an aging millennial is going to come up with to describe why they need a tummy tuck.
Well, I
I
mean,
have
yeah.
some FUSAG because my
Can you please
FUPA
handle
isn't
this?
up anymore.
Yeah.
I've got
Yeah,
the
maybe, you know, they're
FUSAG.
just ahead of their game. They're absolutely ahead of their game.
Carry on. Sorry, I had to
So,
make a point, a tasteless joke there.
no, I'm here for it because I have a tasteless joke coming up. Now, these guys in the Ghost Army, they're working the front lines like the rent is due. The whole goal is deception. And this unit is comprised of people like the last people you would imagine being frontline units. They're artists, they're fashion designers, they're students, they're sound engineers. They are not your standard infantry. They're painters and poets. Like, what the heck, right? So their whole goal is deception, and they have some great stories, and I'm just going to regale you with a few of them. In one instance, Gilbert Seltzer, he's telling his granddaughter, Sarah, that he was in charge of a platoon shortly after arriving in Normandy. His platoon was instructed to take the place of an American anti-aircraft battery that had been set up on the land of a French farmer. The local French farmer is not cool with this. It's noisy. You know, the whole noisy neighbor thing? Like,
Oh,
he's
yeah.
not feeling it,
Are you
right?
saying that if you have a quaint bucolic farm, you don't want a bunch of noisy Americans coming in? How dare
I
you?
guess. Wild,
Why are
right?
we just like, look, because we're consistent.
Truly. Yeah. So he is ex like ecstatic. He is beyond stoked when he discovers that the unit is being moved out during the night. However, the following morning, he saw that Seltzer's platoon had set up four guns for the purpose of impersonating the real battery and drawing fire from the German troops. So the angry farmer approaches Seltzer and he says, quote, "Encore, boom, boom." And Seltzer doesn't know how to answer him. The farmer then punches the rubber gun with his fist, which naturally bounces back. He looks at it and says, "Ha, boom, boom, ha, ha." And in four syllables, it described the mission of our outfit to fool the German army. In another example, just before the actual invasion at D-Day, and remember, they're dealing with the whole Atlantic Wall thing, right? Like, this is kind of a problem. They choose the Straits of Dover, which would have made sense to Hitler as the place to come across because it's the narrowest point in the English Channel.
Right.
And this plan, it makes perfect sense. So they're like, yeah, he's going to totally fall for it without a hitch because, duh, that's the exact place you'd want to go, right? I'm assuming generals say, duh, anyway.
I mean, who doesn't?
I mean, right? So this is led by General Omar Bradley, and supposedly it's based in Kent and had a headquarters housing both Bradley and his staff. Film studios and theaters provided set builders who were brought to Kent to create a mock army. They build barracks, tents, landing craft, all convincing enough to trick the German aerial recon. The airwaves of Kent are then flooded with radio traffic from non-existent units. And then, for good measure, they find an injured German officer trying to get his way back home, and he is, quote unquote, shown a massive armed force gathered in Kent, which includes Patton. He goes on to supply eyewitness testimony to his superiors that the army was real, but in reality, he had actually been shown soldiers in a completely different part of the country.
Could you imagine? Like, this is the time that drama kids really take over and rule. And they're just like, you know what? My mother was wrong. Look at how I'm serving my country. Give me the stipple
Like,
sponge. I need the stipple
absolutely.
sponge.
That is exactly how it's going, right? So right about this time, Patton gets taken out of timeout and he's put in charge.
What do you mean
I
put
did
in
not know
timeout?
this. Yeah, so Patton, I knew you were going to ask that, and I'm so glad I included the notes. Patton had been suspended from any real command for slapping a couple of exhausted soldiers who turn out to have had combat stress reactions. What's
Oh.
that you say? Well, Today, it's what we would know as like short-term PTSD.
Yeah, they had a mental break and he gave him a backhand of justice.
And wasn't so he got a little bit of a, smack on the hand and sent to the corner by Big Daddy government. And so, but they realize like the chain of command realizes the Germans know about Patton and they have a healthy fear of his command. There's actually a really there's a couple of great quotes about this. The first one being, quote, "This posting meant he was still useful, as the Germans feared his aggressive and effective leadership." The second quote, "Patton was the centerpiece of Operation Fortitude South, a deception plan devised by British Army planners. Patton was given command of the fictitious 1st U.S. Army Group. This formation, complete with fake radio traffic, bogus subordinate units, and even inflatable replica tanks and aircraft, was devised to convince the Germans that Patton would lead the main assault in the Pas-de-Calais region of France, where the English Channel was nearest. The operation was an unqualified success. Hitler left the outstanding German 15th Army in the area of operations far too long, even though it was apparent that the Allies had invaded in strength in Normandy."
Wow.
Like, just his being there sent the Germans reeling, like, oh no. During Operation Titanic, which was another one of their events, this is the night the Allied forces set out for Normandy. It's June 5th, 1944. 40 transport planes took off from southern England to the area around Omaha Beach, which would become the most difficult and bloody of the landings. On board these 40 transport planes are 10 soldiers of the Special Air Service, SAS, Britain's elite parachute regiment, and 500 Rupert's. Do you know what a Rupert is?
Lieutenant.
It's crude dummies made of sand, straw, and fabric, and each one has a parachute.
Okay, you know where I
So
got
you've
Rupert
got.
though? I'm reading a Terry Pratchett book about a fictitious war in a fictitious land, because it's Terry Pratchett, and he refers to all the lieutenants as Ruperts.
Okay, that's hilarious. Maybe
Which
it's a
is
play on this
maybe, but
bad
that's why I was like,
dummies.
oh my gosh, did my reading finally set me up for success in life?
Oh my
And
gosh.
I'm completely
I
wrong,
love
but
it when
carry
that
on.
happens.
It
I
didn't
love it
happen
when
this
that
time.
happens though. So remember, there's 500 Ruperts and 10 actual jumpers.
So they're
Right after
flinging a bunch
midnight.
of crash test dummies and then some real ones.
Right. So right after midnight, both the Ruperts and the actual paratroopers were dropped over the French countryside, away from the landing beaches. The Ruperts contain incendiary devices that would catch on fire when landing, which basically destroys any evidence that they had not been real paratroopers starting attack in the first place. The real soldiers had fireworks and gramophone recordings of gunfire, which would be fake battle noises. Now, it is worth mentioning that according to the British archives, the gramophones and whatnot were smashed or somehow destroyed in transport. So whether or not they actually got to use the fireworks and gramophones is kind of unknown as far as what the sources say. One says it's a smashing success, the other source says not so much. But around 3 a.m., the Germans respond to reports of an attack. Thousands of soldiers are diverted away from the area around Omaha Beach to deal with the 10 SAS men on their hand and their hundreds of straw comrades. Now, I think whether this was a success or not, it is really important to me to notice the actions of those SAS troops. They were the first to land on D-Day, and only two of them made it home alive by the end. They were behind enemy lines
Oh.
for 40 days. But thanks to them, hundreds of American lives were saved on Omaha Beach. According to the Smithsonian quote, "Shortly after the D-Day invasion on June 6, 1944, two Frenchmen on bicycles managed to cross the perimeter of the United States Army 23rd Headquarters Special Troops, and what they saw astounded them. Four American soldiers had picked up a 40-ton Sherman tank and were turning it in place. Soldier Arthur Shieldstone says, 'They looked at me and they were looking for answers, and I finally said, The Americans are very strong. There are plenty of more stories. Like I could probably talk about this for hours, but at the end of the day, it's just so special to me that these boys, they use paint and sets and inflatable tanks and artillery to fool the greatest villain the world had known at this point, right?
Yeah.
According to the Smithsonian, it's believed that this unit saved as many as 30,000 American troops.
Wow.
Right? So, following the war, the Ghost Army members, they return home. They settle into normal lives. They get jobs in advertising and architecture, design, theater, art, fashion, radio. You know, the things they
Yeah,
were
they go
planning
back home.
beforehand. Right. Several decades go by and their exploits remain almost completely unknown. Like they don't even tell their own families what they've done because they are given strict orders to follow to not tell any of the Ghost Army information on the off chance that similar tactics will need to be deployed again with a new enemy.
Like,
For
look, we've got
example,
a ton of these inflatable tanks. We might need to use them again, so keep your mouth shut because nobody sat on with a pin in their pocket.
exactly. However, a few articles at the time did get out, but for and they slipped through the censors right after, but for the most part, none of the information about them were classified, unclassified until 1996. Enter Rick Bayer, who I mentioned earlier in my sources. He starts seeking to gain official recognition for the Ghost Army. So he launches a nonprofit Ghost Army Legacy Project, as well as a grassroots campaign for the Ghost Army to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. He says, quote, "I was very conscious of the fact that because of secrecy, these guys had not received any recognition and thought that was something due them." He goes on to say, "I thought that what they did was remarkable, and I was amazed at the degree they were not part of World War II, of the World War II pantheon." In February of 22, the 23rd Headquarters Special Troops and the 3133rd Signal Company Special, which undertook a pair of the sonic deception operations against the Nazis in Italy, were awarded the Congressional Medal, the Congressional Gold Medal, for their, quote, "unique and highly distinguished service in conducting deception operations." He then goes on to say, "Performance and art are not just things we do as recreation. They are a critical part of the human endeavor. The Ghost Army use creativity and illusion to save lives." Then, just a few weeks ago, on March 21 of this year, the seven last surviving men were awarded the Congressional Gold Medal on Capitol Hill before a crowd of more than 600 in attendance.
Holy crap.
Those receiving the awards were Bernie Bluestein, who was a sophomore at the Cleveland School of Arts at the time of his enlistment, and he a private. He goes on to be a private. Seymour Nusenbaum, excuse me, aged 100, as well as John Chrisman, 99, and there were an additional four more watching from home. The New York Times says, quote, "Getting the Congressional Gold Medal for the soldiers took years of work, much of it initiated by Rick Beyer, a film producer. He learned about the unit 19 years ago from a friend's colleague who said someone should make a documentary about them. It took us four sessions of Congress to do it, and it took a whole team," Mr. Beyer says in an interview. "We had 40 or 50 people who volunteer as lobbyists. They were emailing, they were calling, they were visiting offices in person. COVID hit in the middle of that, and we readjusted our way of doing things and kept going. And by God, we made it happen. And for
You
funsies,
no, hold on real
I
quick,
have
because you
pictures."
just said something incredible. Because they used lobbyists. Hubs and I talk often about lobbyists and whether they should or shouldn't exist and the access they should or shouldn't have and wield. But this is a positive use of lobbyists because it's not like
Absolutely.
some big corporation paying ungodly amounts of money for bribery and everything.
Do you want to see some pictures? Of
Yes.
course you do. Okay. Allow me to share my screen because I've got some good ones.
And I don't mean to make it sound like I'm so angry at you for even asking. I mean, just hit that share button.
Here, Here is their insignia.
Oh, okay. So you have the shield and you've got a hand-drawn esbuki. So normal ghosts think white sheet kind of deal, but this ghost has some long arms and is leaning down, looking over his left hand. His left hand is raised up and is launching sparks because, yes.
Now, one of the fun things that I didn't mention earlier that they were incredibly good at is dressing up in other uniforms. Like they mention how they've worn more official uniforms in their duty than most soldiers will ever see in their lifetime.
Well, yeah, they had to have a
Wearing
full costume closet.
wearing full badges and regalia, and they would go to bars and other like local meeting areas and talk very loudly as their plans for what their operation was, and obviously every word of it was a lie.
You know what? That meant that they have some hella budget for, beer and drink. It's like, no, Brian, I don't care that you're still hungover. We are required to go
We have to
blow
paint the set.
$200 at the
Hey,
bar.
if we
So
don't get this information out,
we got to sing loud, proud, and on off key. One, two,
yes.
three, go.
And a go. Exactly. So here's one of their tanks that you can see being carried by four men. It's definitely inflatable.
It looks like an actual tank, but there's just people like. It's just awkward. I mean, I could care about myself, but I need help.
Yeah, that's exactly. Like, if I could get in the middle of it would be fine.
Brian, I can't see. Go backward. You're lifting it too high.
Right? Again, freaking Brian. This is an inflatable dummy tank. It's modeled after the M4 Sherman. It's on the field during Operation Fortitude, which I thought was really cool that
Okay,
this is an
but you're
actual
also seeing it.
operational
If you
photo.
actually look at it, you can see that it looks like there's a string connecting the end of the missile
The
launcher, missile
nozzle,
tube.
yeah.
Yes. Like holding it up because that thing is like super long and heavy and it probably like
Ugh.
bends, like waves like a balloon during the
Could you
Macy's
imagine
Day
a really
Parade.
windy day?
Like,
Yes,
no,
exactly.
bring get the tank back. The tank has blown away
Yeah.
entangled with Clipper.
Oh no.
The tank has popped. It's killed
God
Barney, the
damn it.
dinosaur.
I knew it. Now I want to see one of these in the Macy's parade, so thanks for that. Here's a photo of some of the guys. I think it's just, I don't know who's who, but I think it's
These
really
guys
awesome that we
all
get to
have
see them.
my drunk smile.
They're all consent super content. So actually, one of the really fun characters of this group, hopefully I'm going to get his name right, is Bill Blaz. He was a really well-known fashion designer at the time, and he served on this unit, and his unit adored him. He was always smiling and always sketching. And because this is a unit of artists, they're always sketching each other. And there is artwork out there of him, like in his bunk, drawing his designs that he would actually mail back to Buenos Aires and have, whatever done with them. But he is said as saying, like, essentially, and I'm paraphrasing here, but essentially, he had a really good time. Joining this unit was the first choice he made as an individual to do something like for himself that his parents or someone else in charge didn't decide for him. And so he goes on to say that, like, basically he understood that the war was bad for some, but his job and what he got to do, he really enjoyed every minute of it. So he was constantly smiling. So something tells me he's in this photograph, but I have only seen pictures of him older, so I'm not sure exactly which one he would be. And then for my last one, this is the group of paratroopers that jumped in during Operation Titanic. The one in the front, he's Norman Poole. He was one of the two surviving SAS jumpers. The
He
other guys
looks
with
like he
him
could
are
be
troops he
played.
liberated.
The guy in the front looks like he could be played by a young Willem Dafoe.
Yep, that is exactly what I thought. I'm so glad you said that because I was like, okay, William Dafoe, answer for yourself.
Yeah, you're gonna need to speak up about who your dad or great uncle was because we found them jeans.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of the men in this photo with him are troops he actually helped liberate while he was behind the enemy lines in those 40 days.
Wow.
I'm so impressed by these guys and what they were capable of doing. And I mean, 1,100 troops could look like 30,000 men like that. And it just to throw off the war, like I was so in love with the story. I had so many other things planned to share, and I came across this and I was like, oh my gosh, full stop. This happened recently. We need to tell this story.
Well, and
So there we are.
it's got our beloved World War II.
Because we can't get enough of it. Like, as soon as you learn one thing, you have to learn something more. And I literally thought to myself, okay, I can't do another World War II so soon. Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Wow.
There's my guys. Oh, do you want to see if I can pull it up? Do you want to see what this is? Bernie Bluestein, one of the re recipients.
Okay, so she's showing me a picture of a man who is not 100 years old or close to. I don't care what chronology says. He looks
Yeah.
like he's in his late 70s, early 80s. Age has been kind to him.
Maybe.
Very
Yeah.
grandfatherly face. He's got laugh lines that go from the corner of his eye to his jowl. You're seeing like a almost profile as he's looking, at a 45 degree. He's got glasses. He's got just the quintessential scruff on his chin and upper lip, and he's wearing the most grandfatherly plaid sports coat.
And you can't really see it clearly, but on the one lapel, he is wearing the shield with the ghost.
Oh, I love that.
And here are. This is the son of one of the recipients. This is just a gentleman wearing a very handsome suit.
Yeah.
He attended on behalf of his father, who has since passed away.
Oh.
His name is Mike Bagby, but the father was William Wright Bagby. And then these were the other two, Seymour and John.
Wow.
Grandpas. That's
Yeah,
they're
they're
just
grandpas.
grandpas.
They're
Like,
grandpas.
yeah. That up until very recently were not allowed to tell their families what they did during the war. But could you imagine, like, Grandpa, can you paint with me? Well, back in 44. To hear those stories.
Yeah.
So those are my guys. I'm so
Oh.
glad I got to share them with you. And I hope I didn't take up all of our time. I'm sorry if I
No,
did.
we got time.
Okay,
You ready
good.
for mine?
Yeah, because we
Okay.
have palate cleansers all around.
Okay. So, I'm not gonna I'm gonna tell you my sources, just the main source. I'm not gonna give you article headers. Crisismagazine.com. I'm reading an opinion of theirs. There's a website called historycollection.com. Pulled a factoid from there. Spent quite a bit of time on Wikipedia only because the articles I could find on JSTOR were really, really dry and ecumenical. And then there was a podcast, Betwixt the Sheets, and this is from their Forbidden Books episode.
Okay.
Ready?
Oh, I have so many questions later. I'm so excited. Go.
What are your questions? Let's just start with those.
I don't want to.
Okay. Ennio Silvio Bordomeo Piccolomini,
You made that
probably
entire name up.
you would think. He's born October 18th, 1405. So we're going back.
Okay.
I'm bringing you an oldie, but a goodie. And first off, let me also just say that this is one of those episodes that I only heard passing mention in things. I never heard the full story in a podcast. So tracing and knitting all of this together was harder than you would think. So and it gets this gets wild. We're starting off in the
Okay.
Tuscany region of Italy, where
Okay, I could go for a year there.
Piccolomini, his family is noble, but they're poor. So great bloodline, comes from nobility, but they got a penny between their names. Now, I'm sure people at this time would hear his last name of Piccolo Mini and be like, oh my gosh, yeah, that family. Hell yeah. Doesn't mean much to me though. Now, being a noble family, I had to look up its prominence starts in the 13th century and goes all the way through the 18th century. So there may be people in Italy who go, oh yeah, but I mean, they have fallen from their height, so to speak.
Okay.
Now,
Like, that's my cousin's sister-in-law.
right. So I know I called him Enea. I'm gonna probably switch back and forth between Enea and then Aeneas, basically Italian versus Latin. The reason why I'm gonna get those languages going back and forth and dead name, not dead name him, but go, switch language will
Right.
become more and more obvious later on. Enea ends up becoming fluent in both of those reasons. Reasons are
Okay,
forthcoming. Now,
okay. Reasons are forthcoming. Okay.
yeah, Aeneas, one of 18 kids.
Okay.
Mom gave birth to several sets of twins, but I don't care how you cut it. That's chronically pregnant.
For 20 years.
Chronically pregnant. Like, let's say they
Yeah.
were all twins. That's 9 years of pregnancy.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Oh
that's
my
chronic.
God.
Now, despite the number of kids, you need to remember that we're at the early 1400s in Europe. Okay. My
Right.
last episode, I covered the spread of the Black Death. And it's about this time that the bubonic plague takes its last joyride through the continent and tears through Aeneas' family, leaving only him and his two sisters alive.
Oh my God. But no parents, just him and his two
Well, I
sisters?
know dad lives because he makes mention of working for his dad after this, but I can't figure out if mom survives.
Gotcha. Okay.
Either way, house was at 20 people and drops to five, maybe
Four.
six.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good grief. Okay.
Well, because you look at like him, two sisters, that's three. So maybe four or five, which is,
Yeah.
that's a lot. So
Devastating.
it's yeah. 1423, he's age 18. He goes to university in Siena, and he studies the humanities and civil law. So I'm reading this and I'm like, he took a civ he got a liberal arts degree. Go for him. Look at him go. But then he becomes a teacher. So I'm like, okay, this is shaping up really well. Knowing the end of this story, I'm kind of confused as to how we get from points A to Z, but let's go. And
Live your life, friend.
you have no idea where we're going yet, do we?
Not a freaking clue, and I'm so excited.
So he does this for quite a bit because in 1431, so he's been teaching for 7, 8 years now, he gets hired as a secretary for a bishop in Basel. Basel, Basel.
Okay.
Anyhow, the dude he's working for a man named Bishop Dominicio Caparinca. And Caparinca is deep in his feels and is protesting the Pope. Now,
As you do.
I don't exactly know what he was protesting, right? I didn't dive in that deep because reasons. But the current Pope at the time, Pope Eugene IV, he refuses to give Caparinca a promotion to cardinal. And this bishop feels some kind of way about it. And my computer just gave me the thumbs up because
I tried
Max.
so hard not to notice it, but then I saw your face.
Yeah, and then my face caught it too. And I was like, you know, this is what we're rolling with. I could turn that off, but honestly, I find it more entertaining because it pops up just sporadically.
Really truly, it's part of the fun.
It is. It's, it adds to my chaotic good. Actually, it turns me from chaotic neutral to more chaotic good. So I'm here for it. Now, unfortunately for our man, Enea, his boss runs out of money. And so he sends our boy Enea to a dude named Cardinal Albergati in Basel. And this cardinal sends him on a secret mission to Scotland. And we don't know much about this, despite me looking, because 1400s records are a bit scant.
Well, and think of the history of Scotland in the last 500 years. They were probably burned.
I mean, look, everything else was. Now, we do know that when he gets to Scotland, he, even though he is not a church dude, right? Like, he works for the church, but he is a layman as laymen get. He walks barefoot to the nearest shrine, which apparently is 10 miles in ice and snow. And this significantly damages homeboy's feet for the rest of his life. Now, I don't know if
he needed to do this.
It could have been maybe he felt he needed to like some sort of homage for making it over the ocean. Maybe that was literally like shoes got lost. His bag didn't make the trip. And that was it. I don't know the why. The why is lost to me.
The airline lost his bag. It's in Cleveland.
Yep. Sucks to be you, but here's a bag of grooming supplies that we got from somebody else.
I was going to say, here's a voucher for lunch tomorrow.
Yeah. And $100 off your next flight.
Mm-hmm.
Now, his memoir that we've got, because we've got access to his memoir, which is nuts to me that this is 1400s and homeboy wrote down his thoughts and feelings. He talks very briefly about his work in Scotland and what he was trying to do. He does make brief mention that the cardinal sent him to the Scottish king to curry favor to get back in his good graces for reasons.
Okay.
And that he mentions that he succeeded in what he came for. But that's about it. Like, he's super quiet and hush-hush in his own writings about this. And it makes me kind of like super curious. But we do know that it's also why he's here. He's not just all work and no play because he fathers a kid.
Good on him.
You know, and this kid does later pass away. But I mean, he kind of shows us that he likes to party. He's here for the good times.
Mm-hmm,
he's not
mm-hmm,
all work.
Okay.
He returns back to Basel, and his old buddy, the old bishop, Capranica, he's doing good now. He's a cardinal now. He finally got his raise, his little bit of a promotion, and he goes back to work for this man, now the cardinal. And then apparently drama and politics are endemic in every workplace, regardless of where you work. There's a bit more, like, he's a part of a council that opposes the Pope. And I don't know why. I assume when you're Pope, when you get to wear the big, big, tall hat, everybody listens to you and everybody agrees with you. I didn't recognize that there'd be as much infighting and politics in the church. I just assume some places you abstain from.
No, not for the Pope.
Apparently.
Think about how you get to be the Pope.
I've had to think about that for this story. And it's bizarrely fascinating to me because I didn't think I'd get there. The council as a whole that his boss is a part of opposes the Pope, and he supports his boss, so he supports the opposition, and he even gets named as a layman, he even as a layman gets named to be a provost of a church, and apparently this goes against how the Catholic Church was doing things, and could be I mean, just another sign of maybe corruption and favoritism and all the whole nine,
all the things,
because he shouldn't have gotten this dispensation to be able to be the provost, but here we are.
Yeah. Okay,
so he's kind of working his way up, and he's offered a deaconate in the church, and he turns this down because it would come with a vow of chastity. He's already fathered a kid. Didn't quite work out with that one. He's hoping maybe the next one sticks around on earth a bit longer. He likes the ladies. Ugh. He's not going to be taking this position. Thank you for thinking of me. Good luck in your future endeavors.
Yeah, with love and peace. Deuces.
Yes. And he's even offered to join the electorate for the next pope. And he turns that too, because he's like, no, that also comes with chastity. Me, love the ladies. Get me a post with the ladies.
I said no the first time. Give me a post with ladies. I would like to work for a convent, please.
You know, and it's funny you say that, because in the podcast Betwixt the Sheets, they were talking about how the church's stance on sex has changed throughout the years. And this I found fairly fascinating because there's certain periods of time where the church is very against, sex outside of marriage if it is the priests and the nuns getting it on together. But we recognize that maybe other people outside of marriage will engage in activities, and you guys do you, but we're going to keep the church abstinent.
Churching.
Yeah, and then other times it's like, oh no, actually, like maybe everybody should follow the same rules that we have the priests and nuns subscribe to. And I have found that kind of very interesting. So that was kind of fun things to keep in your noodle noggin as this is all going down. He ends up, this bro is at so many inflection points of history that I just can't even, because in November of 1439, he supports the creation of the anti-pope.
Oh,
And
okay.
he's there to get Amadeus, the Duke of Savoy, coronated as anti-pope Felix V. He's there. Homeboy is there, which I was just like, huh. And so then he's sent to Strasbourg. And while he's in Strasbourg, he loosens up a bit. He fathers a son with a Breton woman called Elizabeth. The baby dies 14 months later, but he gave it the old college try.
I'm trying to remember the anti-pope. Is this the one that partied all the time and was like just the worst pope ever?
I mean, I didn't spend a ton of time really looking at the anti-pope. He doesn't hang out for a long time. He's nicknamed the Peaceful.
Okay, he's not the one I'm thinking of then.
Okay. But it's, so it's after that in 1439, he leaves this post with the anti-pope, and he joins the court of Frederick III.
Okay.
Not Frederick II, not your potato king, but the Holy Roman Emperor. And
Frederick, that the Battle of Crans-Vies is Frederick?
I believe so.
I'm so excited.
He joins the court of Frederick III, the Holy Roman Emperor, and he's there as his poet laureate and secretary. He's the secretary to like everybody in the story, pretty much. And it's there he obtains the patronage of the emperor's chancellor, this dude named Caspar Schlick. And it's here that he pens his magnum opus. I'm going to call it that. Nobody else has, but here's what I'm going with. The name of this
When
book.
you say it like that, I have imaginations.
What are your imaginations?
Is he writing the Western version of like the Karma Sutra?
You're on the right track. It is a piece of erotica and it is titled The Tale of Two Lovers.
Of
It's
course
full
it
of
is. Okay.
woodcuts with actual images.
That answers one of my questions.
And for whatever reason, it's after this he shifts his stance on abstinence. I can't quite figure this out because I feel like you just doubled down. And the now you're
Sure
just
did.
along the path, because it's after this he's ordained a priest in Vienna on March 4th of 1446, which was an Uno reverse that I didn't see.
Maybe his head caveats.
I don't think so, but hold that thought, because it's a year later that the current pope passes away, and now a new pope is put into place. So welcome Nicholas V. Or Nicky Five. And Nicky Five appoints him as the Bishop of Trieste. Now he's barely the Pope for, or barely the priest for a year, and now he's suddenly a bishop.
Yet
And
it took his one boss like a whole lot to become the
right,
cardinal.
like lots of secret deals and wheeling and opposition to the Pope, and he just convinces Nicky Five and gets it done in a year. Go for him.
Good on him.
Now, life continues not to go slowly for our man, because it's in 1450, so 4 years later, that he's sent by his buddy Frederick III to negotiate the marriage of Freddie III to Princess Eleanor of Portugal. So he's brokering that
Okay.
deal. He is involved with everybody. And it's 2 years
I want to see
later.
his group chats.
Oh my gosh, could you imagine?
They've got to be wild.
I just want to see his album. Like, show, open up your photos. Just start scrolling. I'll tell you when to stop.
Fair, fair, okay.
15, or sorry, 1452. He's with Freddy III, and he's there when he's actually crowned emperor. Before
Oh,
then, he was just
okay.
hanging out with Freddy III, who I should say would have been Holy Roman Emperor, but we weren't there yet. I got excited. And I just, at that point, I was like, what else has he done? Because what? Who, what?
He has
And
martial arts on the side.
I can't, you know, maybe don't quite hold that thought, but there's a tie-in.
Course there is.
So 1455, there's another pope who comes to power, and I literally had to go through and count just how many popes have been in this story from the start. And currently we're at Pope five, if you count the anti-pope.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was like, we're at least four.
Right.
Okay.
Like I stopped counting or stopped naming names for a good chunk. It's like, okay, and then he hated that pope, and then he hated that pope, and then there was this pope, but we just, at
That
some
poke
point,
doesn't count.
it's just a revolving door of popes. But 1455 comes around, another pope comes to power. Nia leaves Germany to swear loyalty to Pope Calaxtus the Third. So he leaves Germany to go to this pope. He's going to swear loyalty, and he's joining an envoy to ask the pope for a war against the Turks.
I would like a war with the Turks, please.
May I please, Mother, may I, fa Father, may I, have a holy
Wage
war,
war,
crusade,
please.
perhaps? I mean, we haven't had a crusade in such a long time.
It's been like 200 or 300 years, Father. You let Charles do it.
Right? It's all we want. And there's no more of those guys running around in the white smocks with the red crosses.
What happened to them?
They lost all the money. But anyhow, he gets a strong recommendation from Frederick and the King of Hungary, who's also the King of Bohemia. And they write nominations for our man, Aeneas, to become a cardinal.
Wait,
But
hold on. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Go back. The King of Bohemia and Hungary. What is this one's name?
Ladislaw the Fifth of
Okay.
Hungary.
I was thinking we were entering like Voynich manuscript or Voyage manuscript.
Wasn't that in the 1200s?
Well, when it was in Bohemia, I think it was the 1500s. So I was just curious if I
Oh,
had
okay.
my right timeline.
I mean, we're stumbling close to a timeline you are going to be very familiar with, and I am burying the lead like you wouldn't believe.
You're such a monster. I'm so excited.
I know. So anyhow, these two kings, they're like, hey, our boy, he needs to be a cardinal. He's done the work. He's been at it for all of 15 seconds. You should promote him.
Give or take 5 seconds.
But there's some delays because the Pope, he promised to promote his own nephews first.
Oh, damn. Nepotism at its best.
Finally, December 17th, 1456, and I love that we've got all these dates. He's named a cardinal, and then 2 years later, Calaxtus the Third dies.
Oh, jeez.
And I mean, this is one of those things where I'm like, what is the lifespan of a pope? Because I feel like we've had some really
12 minutes.
long-lived ones, like, but not in here in this story. I mean, I just don't understand. Like, who has life insurance policies on these people? Is it who's putting poison into their cups to collect money? Because I feel like that is what's happening.
I don't think you're wrong or far from the truth, rather.
So once the last pope dies, all of the heads of the church, they start to convene. And we get several figures who are leading, like brushing the dust off their robes, and they're ready for this vote. They're getting ready to run their campaigns, you know, vote me for Pope kind of deal. One
They've got the
candidate,
buttons made.
exactly.
Yeah, okay.
One candidate is the cousin of the French king. Looks like a strong contender to me. One of the other candidates, he is the half brother of Pope Nicky V.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's in the family. And then we got our boy because he's been at it for a hot minute, but he's apparently ready for it. The first boat comes in, and the former Pope's half brother has five boats. And then our man Aeneas also has five votes. And then the second vote comes in, and Aeneas has nine votes. And the king's cousin, so not the original guy who had any, he gets six, but you need 12 to win. So there's some back chat, some wheels and deals. I don't know exactly, how these conversations go, but next thing you know,
Marriage alliances were made.
suddenly our dude gets at least 12 votes and he becomes the next pope. So he was writing dirty books in 1444 and then in 58 gets anointed pope.
You know, he's on side quests, okay? Let him live his
Like,
life.
this is the author of 50 Shades of Grey getting elected to presidency.
You say that, but in the US, that's not far.
You're right. That's the American dream.
Truly.
And remember how he campaigned to one of the earlier popes about wanting a little bit of a crusade, just a touch of a holy war. He's got it to fight against the Turks in his blood. Well, that's pretty much what he sets as his greatest priority. He wants to free Europe from the Turks through a great crusade.
Never ends well.
He gives a 2-hour speech. And he calls for a crusade against Islam in 1459, and he appoints the king of Hungary, who has since turned over, which is why I don't want to give you the name of the last king. So the current king of Hungary is a dude named Matthias Corvinus. And he's like, yo, King Matthias, you're in charge of my group. I need you to go lead a crusade. And I'm going to give you the task of organizing the Catholic military resistance against this Muslim threat that's in the eastern borders.
Okay.
And then it's by March 1462, Vlad Dracul III enters the stage left.
Okay.
For those of you playing at home, that is Vlad Tepes, that is Vlad the Impaler. Of all of our princes in Europe, of everybody playing, of everybody who has met and learned and rubbed elbows with our boy, who's now Pope Pius II, it is Vlad Tepes that is just all aboard this plan for a crusade. Now, he's not motivated by his love for the church. He kind of has a beef against the Turks. Angie, why would he be upset with the Turks?
Oh, you know, well, because there was that time on the basketball court.
No, this don't talk, don't be, don't, yeah. No bullshit, real shit.
Okay, real shit. So first, I'd be a little upset because I got sold to some Turks and I spent some time in their lifestyle, and that's also where I learned how to impale some things. But what I might be really ticked off about at this point is the death of my wife.
Yeah, the fact that the Turks did engineer that entire thing.
I might want vengeance.
Yeah, so for those playing at
My
home
war
who
is holy but different.
yeah, there's chaos and violence in my heart if you are Vlad Tepes. Vlad's dad, to be held down by the Ottoman regime, basically had to give his sons to be raised in the Ottoman court
As
so that if he
wards.
act up, then his sons would just die. And that was a way to keep him on the straight path.
In line, as
And
it were.
yeah, so Vlad has some feelings. Now, here's where things start happening. We get some reports of Vlad's violent victories over the Ottoman Empire, and they are spreading throughout Europe, and Catholics are rejoicing.
How many times can you say Vlad's violent victories?
Pretty awesome, right? Like just that phrasing.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I'm here for that.
I'll try to weave it in a couple more times.
Thanks.
Now, Pope Pius II, our boy Anais, I'm gonna just go by Pius II from here on out. He looks at these campaigns and he is also thrilled that he's continuing to drive Mehmed's forces from Rome, further from Rome. And I loved this because I know in a previous story, or at least talking with Angie, maybe not on a recorded part, Angie knew Mehmed's name. Like it was tip of tongue.
Yes.
And so,
For those playing at home, Vlad Tepes is my hero. And I know if you've been a longtime listener that I have said I have loved a lot of these characters, he was one of my first loves. Teresa may be the violent one, but I love the violence.
explains our friendship when I'm honest.
Doesn't it? You know, we all need somebody to burn the world for us.
And to love, we and the people who are burning it just need the love.
Yeah,
Yeah,
here
it's
we
what
go.
you're here for. So Mehmed II, he's already got some tense relationships with Vlad. He discovers that Vlad has this alliance with Hungary's king, and this is where Mehmed decides that he's going to ambush Vlad.
It's like a
He is
terrible idea.
You know, but hey, here's the deal. You've got a massive army and you're going to just stomp the snot out of this piece of crap who was raised in your household and has the nerve to rage war against you, to stand up to you. You are the king. You fed him scraps from your table and he has the audacity to wave his finger in your face.
The audacity.
Yeah. It's
I
two separate
swear,
words.
some people's kids.
You're not wrong. You're not wrong. So Mehmed assembles a force of almost 100,000 men, and they are marching to conquer Wallachia. And if they're able to conquer this, then they're going to put Vienna within Mehmed's grasp, which is basically the doorstep of Rome. And
This
so
is problematic.
everyone's watching this with bated breath. Now, Vlad and Mehmed go back and forth, and Vlad really earns his reputation in this Pope paid for interaction. I have to say, paid for and sanctioned. We are meeting the man who bankrolls Vlad in the first part of the story.
I love making the connection just now when you said that this at the beginning of the story, just a few minutes ago, was a teacher.
Who was writing dirty books?
From a noble but poor family in Tuscany, I really did not see this.
This coming.
It's like kayaking in the ocean and being hit in the face with an octopus,
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Or better still, walking down the street and the octopus walking up to you, like
Honestly, I won't correct any of this because so basically all this leads to the event, the night attack at Trogovist on June 14th, 1462. And this is where we really meet everything. So, in this conflict, Vlad attacks a Turkish camp at night. His goal is to kill Mehmed. He's trying to assassinate him, but the assassination attempt fails. And Mehmed marches on the Wallachian capital, Trogovist. And that's where he finds a few men, some cannons, not a ton of pushback. And it's after leaving the capital that Mehmed discovers 23,844 impaled Turks that Vlad had killed during his invasion of Bulgaria.
just sitting there,
That
could
exact,
you imagine?
yeah. And those numbers were that was counted. That was counted and recited in a letter that Vlad wrote himself to the King of Hungary, King Matthias.
Oh, that's a day's work right there.
Could you imagine all the tally marks on that letter?
Could you imagine King Matthias's poor interpreter sitting down there, or not interpreter, but his aide, 10,
You
20.
know, King of Hungary felt some kind of way about it because Vlad's imprisoned. He doesn't
These are
want
things.
to, he wants to avoid further warfare. Some sources basically say like he's tired of paying for all of this, even though the Pope is backing it up. He's done with the killing. And here's where King Matthias gets involved, and he sets up Radu the Handsome, Vlad's younger brother, which, what a name. Your name is the Handsome.
Yeah, what do you gotta be? So that could really go two ways, right? Like you could either be drop dead gorgeous or it's what is that called? What is the proper term for that? Where you are the exact opposite of what you're described as.
When it's sarcastic.
Yeah.
When it's
What is
like,
that? There's a phrase for that. Like, oh, it's not an oxymoron, but you know what I mean?
I'm
Like
picking
Little
up
John
the,
is never little.
oh, yeah. Ironic? No, it's not irony.
Anyway, carry on. I'll remember the term. It'll be
Somebody's
3 a.m.
screaming
I'll
it.
text you. I can feel
Okay, that's all I'm here for. Now, the problem with
it.
Radu is Radu's a Muslim convert, and so this is kind of in the face of really pushing Christianity, right? Because now we're setting up a Muslim figurehead in what is now Romania. And the problem is that, because Radu converted, also many of his men converted. So much of the Wallachian army and military or mercenaries, they've switched sides. So maybe Radu's a better political choice. And to validate the fact that King Matthias imprisons Vlad, he blatantly forges a bunch of letters to show Vlad conspiring with Mehmed. And he's
Yeah, of
basically like,
course.
look, Pope, look what I got. Look, he's a traitor. By the
Ugh,
way, just
shucks.
ignore Radu the Handsome. He's fine. He's fine. He'll be fine. Nothing bad will
He's
happen.
so handsome. Just turn face. It's fine.
Yeah. Now, Rome and Venice, they see their man, Vlad Tepes, as a crusader. He has spent vast sums of money backing up this army. He's done a lot of, praying for the souls of the men that Vlad is dispatching. Like, Vlad is our man. He's leading the Christian crusade. He's doing what I have fought and campaigned for my entire life. I joined the church.
The
I gave up
thing.
sex so that I could start a holy war. Like, you can't
Weird.
imprison my man. He is the dude. Now, despite all of that, King Matthias isn't letting him out. He's done. And he knows that if Vlad gets out, he's going to really trump these charges and go back to doing what he's good at, which he's really good with a skewer. Really good. Now,
Great with a stick.
yeah, the Pope's not convinced with that Vlad did anything wrong. This is his boy, and sunk cost fallacies and all that. But he sends a group of emissaries to go see the incarcerated Dracula. And the emissaries come back with the description of Tepes that correspond very clearly with the Renaissance portraits that we have of him. Now, despite all of this, the Pope dies because they all die in the story. August 14th, 1464, he dies of a fever. And when he dies, his crusade also ends. Now, his.
Hold on, wait. The Pope, our friend, the teacher who wrote naughty
Yeah,
books.
Pope Pius
Okay.
II. He kicks the
Just
bucket.
making sure I'm still
Yep.
tracking.
Yep.
Okay.
He's kept the seat warm for longer than the average pope in the story, so he decides to,
Vacate.
clock out.
These are things.
His rule actually is known for him doing amazing things, like, I mean, maybe not the Crusades, despite the overlap with Vlad the Impaler. But he actually condemns the extravagant lifestyles of cardinals, which I am here
Okay.
for. He's condemning slavery of just the newly baptized Christians.
The former ones can stay slaves.
Or the oldly baptized, the ones who've been baptized a while. Like, it's a weird clarification. Like, that's a strange caveat. But
Yeah,
either way,
okay.
he's against it. Now, I just want to close this bizarre overlap in history because he dies in August of 1464. January of 1475, Vlad's brother, Radu the Handsome, dies of syphilis.
These are things.
These are things. And when you're that handsome, I honestly, I didn't,
Syphilis.
Yeah. I hate to say that syphilis comes up a lot in history, but
It comes up a lot in our stories.
and I'm not saying that that's in my search filters. Must include
No, but
syphilis.
Google definitely knows, you
Google
know?
does fine-tune these results. The algorithms favor syphilis for me.
I almost just
You literally, I almost watched you spit take and spray the screen with whatever was in that can.
strawberry lemonade.
That would have been gloriously sticky. I'm going to try
And I
harder
would've
next
been
time.
so sad.
Now, the crazy part is that when we look at Pope Pius II on the whole, we have a ton of his writing and more than the Tale of Two Lovers. We also have his commentaries, which is his narrative about himself. Now, he's writing it in the third person perspective, following Caesar's example. And there were posthumous editions that altered some of the content that may have been judged inappropriate, because again, he was writing porn during his lifetime. So perhaps he may have had some parts that needed to be cleansed a little bit.
A
I
nom
do
de guerre would have been helpful.
possibly. Now, I do want to end it with a quote about him and a quote that he made about his own writing, which I think is a pretty cool thing to end with. He says, My style of writing is unpolished and bald, but it is frank and without trappings. I never write with labor because I do not stretch after things that are too high for me and which I do not know, but what I have learned to write.
I'm sorry. Could he say that about the rest of his life, Mr. I was the teacher and now I'm the Pope?
I'm just saying that maybe with everything he's accomplished in his life, he could write everything but a fucking cookbook.
Or maybe he could. Maybe he made a great Eggs Benedict. We don't know.
That's true. But I will leave you with some of the images that I was looking at prior to you joining. This is one woodcut from his Tale of Two Lovers. I'll let you describe what you are seeing.
some voyeuring. So there are, is that a male lover on the right? They're holding in his lap a female lover is what it
Yes,
appears to be.
that's
Okay.
what I'm seeing.
So it's you've got a checkered floor and then this, you know, rather big, luscious bed, and the lady lover is in the lap. What is next to her? Is that a charcuterie board?
I don't know. There's a
I'm
lot
feeling
about this
charcuterie
that I feel
board.
like are context clues that I just don't have the context for.
Yeah, we do. The clues do not help. So there are embraced in a sensual kiss, and there's drapery on the left, like looks like linen drapery with some sort of decoration, and someone peeking around the corner. It looks as though he is standing next to another bed as well. So perhaps we're in some sort of brothel,
I
or
don't know.
not.
I
He
don't
could
know.
just be a servant. That is a big voluptuous bed with the canopy and everything, and they are definitely embraced in some
They are making the beast of two
action.
backs.
Perfect. That's a great way to word it. Thank you for that.
That's Shakespeare.
I will never see it the same.
But yeah, these are
Yeah.
woodcut paintings or woodcut prints that were put in one of many or two of many that made it throughout his book, The Tale of the Two Lovers.
Could you imagine being the person that had to cut these woodcuts?
No,
I'm sorry, you want a what?
I want his hand on her bosom. You need to put the hand higher
Yeah.
on her
Yeah,
bosom.
and please give the gentleman peeking around the drapes, he needs to have what looks to be like a very Asian hairstyle, and face for that matter. But give him a soft, concerned look, not like a creepy, concerned look.
Yeah,
Yeah.
just making sure everything's going the right direction. Look.
Yes, that is exactly the face he's making. Oh,
Yeah.
our boy is doing great. He has his hand on her bosom and she is embraced in a hug with him. Their feet
Yeah.
are crossed. They seem pleased.
But
I can never unsee this.
that is the story of Pope Pius II, the man whose story intersects, like, I felt when I got to the spy part that I had hit peak weirdness before he hit Pope. And then
And then you were wrong.
I realized that the secret mission to Scotland was the least notable thing in his entire story.
What a wild life. I am here for it. Yeah, that's the definition of unhinged right there. Yeah. Okay, I loved that. That made my whole day.
I mean, it was a lot of like, okay, but honey, Hub, sit down. I gotta tell you. Okay, but did you know about the Vlad the Impaler inroad?
Element, like, did you see this coming? Because I did not see this coming.
No, this is when like there's a bizarre crossover episode that you didn't see occurring in your latest historical novel because you didn't recognize that that was the same universe. Like, I didn't know.
Yeah, it's so weird how the world connects like that and how our stories constantly call back.
Yeah.
Like, do you remember? Oh yeah, he was the whatever.
Yeah,
Like,
the dude who found the
that's
Battle of Caranxabes. Like, I had totally forgotten that like connection until you said it. I was like, actually, yes, same bro.
hilarious. What a small world we live in, even historically, like what a small world we live in.
And it just goes to show that some people really get they just have, he just clearly had main character energy.
He did. He very much did. Yeah. He identifies as the whole show.
And I got to the point where I was like, okay, yeah, I clearly have to splinter off and tell the story of Vlad the Impaler and the night attack and that entire bit. But I still have to bring it back to the Pope because what the hell? Like,
Yeah. What a while. I'm gonna, my poor husband. You can send him your regards.
I shall.
In fact.
But now, honestly, thinking back about your story about the Ghost Army, I want an enamel pin with their squadron.
You can get them. As far as I know, when I was looking at the artwork because I wanted to see, some of the and like obviously I found you the pictures of the tanks and stuff. I wanted to see some of what they did, and I'm fairly certain there's a shop online you can buy them from.
They're like cheap too. We're talking like two, 3 bucks.
So one of the things that is just one of the things they did, and I'm gonna get my numbers wrong, so like don't quote me on this, but one of the things they did was make something like 40,000 counterfeit badging and patches, and a lot of them are still out in the world to be seen and got.
How have I not heard of this?
Because the news wasn't released until 1996, and even after that, they weren't, it was just declassified. It wasn't like people were shouting it from the rooftops, which I find to be the most interesting part. Like, if I was in this army, in this unit, and alive in 1996, and this gets released, I would literally set my entire family down and be like, okay, now I can tell you. Like, this is what I did in the war. Because up to that point, they were sworn to secrecy.
You know, you're not wrong because I know when Gramps served, he was stationed in Hungary and he'd been sent to the place in Monterey where you learn languages. I can't remember the name of it, like the Defense
Okay.
Institute or something like that, but he learned Bulgarian.
Okay.
And I remember going, why? He's like, reasons. That's it. Just can't talk about that yet. And he goes, but then he made comments about like basically being a spy is just really boring. It's listening to a bunch of really boring conversation.
I mean, that checks.
Oh, I
I
want
did
one of
not
these
get
pins.
the I did not get the pleasure of getting to meet either of my grandfathers, but one of them was on the beaches in Normandy when they stormed it, and the other served in the Pacific. So that's pretty cool. I have the letter from the president thanking him for his contributions to the war effort.
Wow.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I'm sorry. I got really excited by Angie's story and then thinking all the way back. Okay, so if you're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe Angie and Teresa haven't covered the blank crossover that they clearly haven't met or that seen. Like, we're here for it. You should let us know.
Fill us in.
Give us a reason to spiral and not accomplish any of the housework. Laundry can wait because laundry is always here for us. And I can't say that I'm ever
Truly.
here for laundry.
I never am, but you know what? It's so consistent. I can really appreciate that.
And if you're thinking,
In fact,
I'd love to actually figure out a place to tell Teresa and Angie anything, you totally can. It's going to be unhinged.historypod@gmail.com. And if you're thinking you've gotten a lot from this, rate, review, subscribe, and tell your favorite washerwoman about this episode and how they're going to be so excited to have something to listen to while they do laundry. And on that note,
God love
goodbye.
them. Bye.